CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
Pete, watching this, like, I just want to go and...
Adult themes.
But, like, the whole this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
Hey everyone, this is B. Jermaine, aka the Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to this long-awaited new episode of the Super Podcast, and it is a very special episode, I might add. And with me, as always, is my very awesome co-host and the Super Marcy of all things at a supermarcy.com. And that, of course, is Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello. And yeah, if anything is super, I guess it's just because of me. So you can thank me.
Well, I mean, that is true, Marcy. And also, it's like, it's the website, it's all the podcasts. It's definitely all this due to you, Marcy.
Yeah. Like I said, you're welcome, Superman. And Super Mario.
Yes.
But yeah, after that lovely, weird introduction, which would you expect anything less? No, you wouldn't. Yeah, we are back with a new episode and a very exciting episode. And hopefully this is something we'll be doing a bit more of as well. But yeah, Bede, what are we doing today?
Well, Marcy, well, we got a very exciting episode today because this is one of our special interview episodes of the show. And we are talking to someone who has a new film that is currently doing this festival circuit. At the moment, he is a podcaster, an actor, and filmmaker who I previously talked to on my other podcast, Bead versus the Living Dead, about his remake of Night of the Living Dead. And he's here to talk to us about his sophomore effort, which just happens to be a slasher film called Meat. Let's all say hello to Roger Cotters. Hello, Roger, and welcome to the Super Podcast.
My gosh, I'm so excited to be back in your presence, at least like audio back in your presence. And I can see you. Like, obviously, the listeners who are just hearing the audio don't know that I can at least see their visuals. So it's so lovely to see you, though it be through a computer screen. Lovely to see both of you again. How are you doing?
Yes.
Doing pretty well so far.
Yeah. Doing good. We're like awkward now for some reason. Like, the guest is here. We got to behave.
Oh my God. Now misbehave, please. You know me by this point. Get weird.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for giving us such a slashing good time of a movie with Meat.
Oh God, that was wonderful description to hear. That makes me so happy. It wasn't terrible. I'm thrilled. First of all, like, I've only sent this out to a few select viewers. Like, I've definitely been doing the press junket or whatever you will with it. Overall, I've done a small handful of podcasts, and I definitely wanted you all to see it. I was so thankful that you wanted to cover it, because last time I spoke with you, it was regarding Rebirth. I mean, that was a while ago. And I've been intending to come back on the show. Unfortunately, I had a back issue that prevented me from coming on the last time I was scheduled, which we will make that up separately for sure. But I have to acknowledge that you recently, did you not just cover We Bury the Dead? Did you not just review that?
Well, I did on Bead versus the Living Dead, yes. So.
Right. Just know I'm going to be listening to that as soon as I watch it. I have been chomping at the bit to see that movie. I'm so curious like to hear what you think of it. I don't know your opinion at all, but just know like I already have that lined up. As soon as I watch it, I will then just then be listening. I'll be jumping over to your podcast, Beaver vs. Living Dead, to listen to that. I'm very excited. But I'm so back to like so happy to just be back with you guys. I think this will be a really fun conversation, and I really appreciate you giving me like kind of a platform early on to talk about Meat before it's even like available to the public. This is really exciting for me. Thank you.
Well, it's definitely exciting for us, and we're very thankful that we had the opportunity to watch the film. And I mean, do I just sit here and say, so, Roger, did you just make a movie that was, like, specifically designed to entertain Marcy, or...
I mean, yes, I'm going to say yes to that, for sure. I mean, if that's your takeaway, awesome.
Yes. My takeaway, as it finished, I'm like, I feel like that was made just for me. It's got all the things I enjoy and like having in a film, but there's also the more serious side to it. But then when there's all sorts of things going on, which we will definitely talk about, I'm like, this just feels like it was made for me.
That's perfect. I mean, it was definitely intended to appease like gay men, just queer people in general, and women who love horror, who are sick of seeing naked women in every movie that they watch within the horror genre. I was definitely like leaning into it. So like for you as a woman, to take something positive away from that is very satisfying for me, because that was definitely something I had in mind. But overall, I wanted to make a film that was like shown through a queer lens, that if you're cool with queer people, if you can hang with queer people, or if you just are a queer person in general, hopefully you'll take something away from it and enjoy it for what it is.
Well, as someone who identifies as a heterosexual, cisgender, white man, I very much enjoyed your film. So people like myself can enjoy this film as well. And I love the fact that it, and this is not any type of put down or anything like that, just how super gay it is. I mean, that's what I really enjoyed about it. And because I know you and I have talked about Meat before, briefly, yeah. Roger. And I just love the fact that it's like, you know what? I'm going to make the most unabashedly gay slasher film out there. And I think you did a great job with that.
Thank you. That makes me very happy. Like, and when I say like people who can hang with queer people, like one of the things that was kind of looming over me making this is I feel that there's almost this anticipation or expectation that if a queer person is going to make a horror movie, that it's going to hold its punches, that it's going to like lean into some kind of shtick or some kind of trope, and that the horror is going to be secondary. And I like knew that couldn't be the case. Like if I have a straight cis man who is willing to sit down and watch this movie with an open mind, then hopefully the slasher elements deliver for them as a horror fan, as someone who enjoys the genre. So like that was definitely something that was important to me. I knew going into this that for as queer, as outwardly queer as I wanted it to be, which was extremely queer, I also wanted it to be equal parts scary, equal parts gory, equal parts violent. So with any kill scene, you know, we went all in. We really went all in with this movie. And I like to think we delivered, I hope.
Yeah, definitely. I think absolutely. And something I appreciate and enjoyed with this, and we did sort of briefly touch on it just on when I messaged you after I watched the film, is that it's a very giallo type film, both I guess visually, but with how the story unfolds. And It just seemed like the giallo influence vibes, however you want to say it, kind of really fit with I guess the story and like location wise as well. Was that something like intentional, unintentional, or just like as it kind of felt to me, it just felt like a natural fit for everything, I guess.
Yeah, I think like growing up as a slasher fan who has loved the subgenre for as long as I have, I think it's inevitable to have taken away influences from giallo, just because, I mean, it's such a beautiful art form. Like, there is a specific visual quality. There's, like, a sumptuous visual quality that comes with giallos, and it's very focused on, like, the cinematography, the focus, the racking of focus, great visual reveals, and really just color palette. Like, there's just so much that giallo does right to manipulate, like, this, your sensations when you're watching it. So I think, like, growing up loving films like Suspiria, it just naturally has an imprint on me. I think it's some things I've always kind of played with a little bit. But, like, once we started developing what really is a revenge slasher, so many of the great giallo films, the big reveals behind the who, what, and why, it comes from a very emotional standpoint, an emotional place. And I think the American interpretation of that in some slashers has become very watered down, and I wanted the inevitable reveal in this, the motivation behind the killer, to come from a place of intense emotion. And I think because there's so much emotion infused into, again, the who, what, and why of what's happening, what's unfolding here, that I think really the giallo themes and influences kind of come from the structure of it. Because, like, yeah, I mean, it's a whodunit with a high head count, but it's a long movie, and it's because we chose to take time to really let the characters kind of based in the story and breathe and develop. And I think that's maybe why I'm hearing a lot, because I am getting a lot of that mention, and it's so flattering, and I absolutely see why. And I there's no way I could say I haven't been influenced by giallo style, just cinema in general, because it was such a major aspect of growing up a fan of just the horror genre, period.
Yeah. And I feel like it reflects a lot just with the colors and the vibrancy. Like, yeah, I mean, if anyone has seen the original Suspiria, the film just has this wonderful quality that it plays with the colors and brightness and darkness, and everything in some way or another stands out. So I think that was pretty cool.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you. And I've got to say, Zach Schildwachter, who is also my assistant director and co-writer and wears many other hats, and Mick Coons, my cinematographer, my director of photography, and again, wears many hats, but they work together to develop a really specific light, like, I guess, palette, if you will, to work with. One of the great things, like, we've been filming this over years, and first thing we ever did was, like, a promotional series of promotional shoots. I'm sure you remember this, because I've been releasing these photos forever, but
yeah.
We started playing with the lighting and the color palette early, early in. And the one nice thing about this is it kind of almost lends to what you're saying, the giallo reference, because, like, a lot of this is rooted within the world of the gay bar. And, like, when you think of this world, this moody, dramatic, like, flamboyant universe, when you're in the bars, there's so much color to play with. The lighting, all of it is very dramatic, and so you can afford to have this cool usage of color and just kind of just this eccentric, over-the-top aspect to how you, like, light this film, because when you're in that world, it can adapt to that. And then you'll notice there are certain scenes in Meat when you're out of the gay bar world, if you will, and you're just in mundane, everyday light. We kind of let it really flat. We purposely, like, didn't get as creative with the lighting, with the color, because we almost wanted to create a separation of worlds. Like, when you're in the gay bar, it is that larger-than-life universe, and the lighting really helped us play that up.
Mm. Oh, it definitely, definitely works like that. Like, it's almost, I don't want to say it's a, like, it's subtle, but it's a clever, almost subtle thing to have, because you feel it as you transition from, like, that to just the everyday life aspect. So, yeah, I think it's pretty cool. Beat, sorry, you can chime in now.
Well, I think one of the things that really stood out for me about the film is, like, not beating around the bush, it is a long film, just over 2 hours long, which I will admit, when I sat down to watch it, I was actually surprised by it. It's like, oh, I didn't expect this to be as long as it did. But what is great about the film, though, is you actually use that time to develop your characters, make them more well-rounded. So they're not like your stereotypical characters we see in slasher films who are just one-dimensional and we want to see them die. You actually bring a lot of dimension to each one. So was that always the intention when you sat down to work on the film to make characters that felt more rounded compared to other characters in other slasher films?
Absolutely. I knew that I needed a few things to help this film stand apart from just being another slasher. I just didn't want it to be a slasher that just happened to feature queer characters. I wanted to be a story about queer characters that is also a slasher. I wanted the characters to kind of be first and foremost. And so when I started writing the script, like I really started writing the script kind of around the time I was working on Rebirth. Like, I mean, we're saying back around like 2016, we were still in editing for Rebirth. That took forever. And I knew that like whatever I did next, I didn't want to be like a fan film or a tribute film. I wanted it to be a work that came from me, that was completely something that I developed. And I just figured as a queer individual, I'm going to tell my personal story better than anything else. I want to infuse some aspects of my life and what I've experienced into these characters, because I'll be able to write to that experience. And so, not saying that I've done some of the things that the characters do in this film, but I grew up in the queer community. I grew up in the gay bars. I lived that life, and I have seen people do crappy things. I've seen people die from drug abuse. I know people who have passed from drug usage, I'll put it that way. And I just felt like I had some really, dare I say, meaty material to infuse into the storyline. And so I knew I didn't want to write something paper thin. Like, I've grown up watching slashers, and I've never even seen a queer character that I feel is even like really memorable. Like, there's a couple characters that were like kind of maybe like Cherry Falls, the made for TV slasher Cherry Falls. Brittany Murphy's best friend is clearly gay, and I think they crack a joke about it, but that character is also the first one to be killed. You barely really get anything from them. They almost feel like a caricature of a person, and then they're offed. And so I just didn't want to see characters that just felt like I said, caricatures or stereotypes. I wanted them to be fully rationalized, three-dimensional individuals. And so that meant that they needed to have like the proper story and material to work with. And like I'll say, like at one point with the cut, like we cut it down to just like it wasn't 90 minutes, but it was like maybe like 105, and it was a lot closer to like the quote-unquote ideal runtime. And we had like vacuumed out all of the material that like gave this film a heartbeat. And I just was like, we lost what makes this like special and unique. We got to put it back in. And so I just opted. I was like, you know what? I like a long film. I'm ADHD. I'll just like pop a pill and like pay attention. And I recommend you do the same. But like, I mean, truthfully, like I feel the extra time frame does the characters justice. And the comment you've made, I've heard from multiple people now, way more people have been okay with the runtime than have complained about it. And it makes me feel really satisfied. I'm justified, I feel, in giving it that extra time to let those characters evolve and grow.
Yeah, I think, like Beto, I was like, oh, wow, this is like over 2 hours. All right, let's see what we're cooking with here. See how meaty we get. But like, for me, it's like, I think especially with how things are structured, we get the beginning and we don't get like the best idea of who these characters are initially. Mm-hmm. And then as we move past, I guess, the inciting incident, it's where you get to experience and get a feel for the complexities of all these characters. And then, of course, on the side, you have the slasher element. But I feel like it's a lot more interesting to have that inciting incident where we don't really know too much about these people than to learn later. And then it shows you that there's always shades of gray between everything. So it just, feel like it adds. And then when you have this killer, you're not necessarily wanting to see these things happen, but it does depend on the character. Because as we've said, they're complex. It doesn't mean we're going to like every single one. Everybody's going to have their faults and stuff. But I feel like that in itself, every kill hits differently for each different character rather than these are just generic whatever. You actually feel something different every time something happens. But then at the same time, because we're learning everything and we're getting more backstory, there's your red herrings and you're still trying to work out, okay, who's doing this? There's all different bits of motivation. Oh, wait, but now this person's been killed. Like, everything kind of just really meshes together well that you experience something a bit different from the usual slasher just in general because there's more, there's meat to the characters.
I love the way you put that. Thank you. But I mean, you specifically said gray area, and I have used that term to explain what I was exploring with these characters. I made a very intentional choice to open this film up with a really severe, realistic, and, I mean, horrible incident. I mean, think of the classic slashers, the whodunit slashers. There's always an inciting incident that kind of sets the ball into motion. And we've seen all kinds of things. We've seen twin sisters thrown out windows. We've seen twin sisters come back having been separated from their sibling from birth and being vengeful. We've seen all kinds of absurd scenarios. You feel like a varying scale of emotions that come from these different reveals. Some of them are funny, some of them are sad, some of them make you mad. But I knew for this, I was like, I think it would be really easy to do a slasher that's just campy, and then the reveal leans into it. And I was like, no, like, I want to give my all to this story, and I want it to be something that is going to really hit for viewers, and I want to touch on some topics that may be feeling kind of taboo, and I also want to explore, like, the idea of, like, comeuppance, and, like, who are we to say who deserves what kind of punishment? Who are we to say that that person necessarily deserves to die? Well, the people in this film certainly deserve some kind of punishment, whether they're likable or not. Some of these characters, you start to come to like them, and you almost, like, stop and you're like, oh my god, but that person did something really horrible. And, like, I feel like almost like I cannot like this person. But some of these characters are going through their own journey of guilt, regret, shame. They may be trying to completely move on. They may be out abusing drugs or being reactionary to it. Every different character that is involved with what unfolds here has a different response to it. And they're all very human responses. And so I think that when people watch this film, I think like a lot of people, their first instinct is to be like, I hate these people through and through. There are no redeeming qualities for what they did. And that makes sense. But we are human. We are flawed, and you couldn't tell a good story without flawed characters. And I felt that I could have had sugar-coated queer characters that just seemed like pleasant and likable and nice, and there was nothing more to them, but that would have made for kind of a boring story. I wanted something that was really going to make people think and make people feel and make people question how they're feeling. And that's why I think I went as big as I did with that opening 15 minutes of that film, is because that kind of toys with your emotions the whole runtime of the movie. And that was really intentional.
Oh, it definitely does. It caught me off guard. And I think that's kind of the point, because you're not quite sure what's actually going to happen. And, but then again, like, this happens, but it's not as black and white as you think it is. And that's what I like as well. But as you mentioned, you're not sugarcoating anything. But it's just being, like, just a raw, honest portrayal of characters. And, like, people exist that are like this. They have their good things, their bad things. People have done terrible shit before. It doesn't matter who you are. Things and complex people are universal to every kind of community. And I think it's important to just normalize that this is a thing and we can tell these stories. So That's like a big thing I appreciate. And I think you and I discussed it after you'd watched it, Bede, just like it's refreshing just to have just raw, honest characters. We're not holding back. This is just who people are. And it's not as clear cut as just being black and white. It's there's shades of grey everywhere. There's a spectrum of things. Mm. And just, yeah, something different and refreshing just overall for like a horror slasher film. But also it's great that it is a very queer film. I'm almost like, can we make it more gay somehow?
I don't know how.
just more close-up shots. That's what Marcy said.
Maybe an extra two buttholes and a few more pairs of balls, maybe.
I'm sure I can get them. I pulled some wonders already. I'm sure I can get them.
Well, I think that's also, too, what I think is makes your film stand out from other sort of queer-centric horror films out there is you are putting the sexuality on the screen. Because with your film Rebirth, your prior film, you weren't afraid to show zombie nudity, especially what that zombie had for lunch like the week prior.
We got asshole and we're thankful.
Yes. And also,
it was good that 28 years later needed to show like 20 inch zombie dong. So
exactly.
It was competition. Exactly. I love it.
But I like how you sort of doubled down even more so in this film. Like, I think I saw every aspect of the cast in this film, whether I wanted to see it or not. But I do like the fact that it's like, you know what? We're going to have lots of ass shots or shots of penises and just every other part of the human anatomy on full display in this movie.
I mean, with a movie entitled Meat, like, how could I not? I
guess we need to see the meat.
We got to like serve it up for sure. But I mean, and again, very intentional. Like, I definitely explored it with Rebirth. It's funny because like I'm so hesitant to do it. Like I act like all demure on set, and I'm like, okay, fine, like let's do it. And then like these scenes come out, and there are these horribly graphic scenes of nudity. But you know what? I think there's something to be said about the discomfort that comes with being fully exposed. Like, a lot of the nudity that you see in the film is during times of discomfort. Like, there's a couple sexy scenes in Meat, but most of the time when you see people naked, it's more to be vulnerable. And I think that that's one of the most, like, intriguing things to play with incorporating nudity in a horror film. But, like, really, I think the biggest thing and one of the earliest things that I wanted just to, like, embed into the DNA of this film, I knew I wanted to play with it, was, like, it is a slasher trope to fully expose women, and especially right before they die. The age-old trope of, like, the slutty girl taking off her bra, and then it's a sex scene, and then she gets killed off, and maybe you see a dude's butt cheek. But the women are always put in these horribly vulnerable situations. We've seen full frontal female chase sequences, like, in My Bloody Valentine 3D, and even taking it back, I keep using the reference, but one of my earliest influences was Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2, that big locker room sequence where, I mean, it's two girls, full frontal, they start kissing on each other for no reason, and like, it's just so weird, and then there's like a violent kill. And so, like, the discomfort for you as a cis straight man watching this film, I applaud you, first of all, but also, like, the moments of seeing, like, the nudity, the penises, all of that, and, like, the like, awkwardness that probably comes with that. Like, I am really trying to capitalize on a sensation men really don't feel very often, that women who are fans of this genre feel all the time and have had to numb themselves to that. It is just a trope of seeing busty women getting off in violent ways, and I'm just flipping that, and now it's naked men, and like, let the guys feel that discomfort for a time.
Well,
I'm not complaining at all. A, because I will absolutely look at lovely naked men all the time. But to quote our dearly departed friend Lee Gambin, just always objectify men's bodies, stylist. So I will continue to.
Amen, sister.
And he said, we need more of that in films, and I'm like, yes, we fucking do.
I definitely did not feel any discomfort because, I mean, obviously, as I said before, heterosexual cisgender white man, I've seen my many slashes with so much female nudity, and I do love and appreciate all that. But sometimes you just have a moment, it's like, there needs to be a bit more male nudity in these movies, because it's so that way it's kind of equal footing. I think even Marcy on our other show on the Super Network, the 2B Tuesdays podcast, whenever we do watch a slasher film or if there's a movie that has a sex scene in it, like if the woman's fully naked, full frontal, but we barely see any of the men, I think we always say, hashtag, where's the dick?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's been very few times where we're like, oh, there's her full frontal, but then we're like, oh, there's some penis. Like, that rarely happens, but we need more of it. More penis, well, where's the penis, show the penis.
I like to think for this one, it'll be hashtag, there's the dick, because
yes.
I definitely try to come through there's on it. Dick. So. Just be informed. Just know it for sure. And obviously, you are a very progressive-minded cis male, and we appreciate that. And I think that for any progressive-minded individuals in general who sit down and watch this, I did want to make sure that for all of the dong that I was going to be showing, like, I also was like, well, let me make sure that I give them the horror experience as well. Like, they've got to have the kills, they've got to have the gore. And so I did want to make sure that I balanced it out. This is as much of an exploitive queer film as it is a true slasher. And I did really want to make sure that I served in equal amounts on both sides of that spectrum.
There definitely was. And at times, at the same time.
Yes.
But this is going off a little bit, and we won't obviously do any spoilers, but my props is that I usually know it's a whodunit. I usually can work out who the whodunit did the what. Yeah, no, I completely thought it was something different than what it turned out to be. So I applaud that Marcy did not know what the hell was going to happen. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, I've been thanking you this whole time because you're complimenting it quite a lot, and I appreciate that. But, I mean, a killer reveal can make or break a film. A bad killer reveal can ruin a franchise. A good killer reveal can help a film, like, withhold the test of time. Like, look at, like, a Scream 4. Like, that reveal in Scream 4 was great when it came out, but now with social media being all-consuming, that whole reveal with her niece wanting to become like a, basically a social media star, that hits now more than ever. That
it
is a good reveal.
So much, because I rewatched them, like all of them, and I'm like, this actually makes more sense now. But you get like stuff like, I think that was just the genius of Wes Craven and a lot of his ideas as well. With, I'm like, man, some of these things, like, it's 30 years later and these are just hitting better now somehow.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Well, and I really wanted the final reveal here to just have some weight to it too. Oh, like, it was like, it could have gone a lot of different directions, but I wanted something that I feel that a lot of queers who watch this, to a certain extent, I think it'll hit home. I think there will be a lot of relatability. I wanted a reveal that had an undercurrent of sadness to it. Just as much as you question how you feel about the quote-unquote protagonist, because even the hero is a reluctant anti-hero at best in this film. But also with the villain, like, talk about Shades of Grey. Like, I wanted something that would leave you feeling kind of gutted, like, literally and figuratively. It's a slasher. But, like, I wanted something that, again, like, played with the emotional strings to the very end. And so we're keeping it really vague. Obviously, a lot of people listening to this haven't seen the ending yet, but I'm really proud of the ending. I think that it hits just as strong as it needs to. And for a 2-hour and 15-minute long movie, it better have a payoff. So we put a lot of effort into that ending, and I hope it hits. One of the nicest things that I have been hearing is, truthfully, like what you just said, vast majority of people. I really don't think many people at all. I've had maybe one person guess the reveal at the end of the film, and I have had countless people like come up and say, I had no idea. I was so surprised. Yeah. It blew me away. And like for that to be the final note that you conclude on, to hit with that kind of like shock factor, yeah. Again, I think like that can really sustain a film.
Yeah, because I think even if I had worked things out, like again, you have motivation and stuff like that. It's like, oh, okay, or blah, 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 blah. But it's like everything fits into place, even if you have no idea that it's coming. So I thought that just worked really, really well. And again, like everything's not so clear cut and you do feel different things because you've experienced such a journey in getting to know every single character that, yeah, like worked well for me.
Thank you.
Well, I was going to ask because you got quite a collective cast for this film. A lot of new faces who have only had prior acting credits to this. And also you've got a few familiar faces that I've seen in other work of yours. Like you have Rachel Anderson, who I loved as Helen in your film of Reaper. Mm-hmm. She has a small role here, and I thought she was great here. And also Caitlin E. Newberry from Mother Krampus 2.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, today is Caitlin E. Newberry's birthday, so I just have to say happy birthday. Caitlin and I have become very close friends since Mother Krampus 2. We've been on an array of bad film sets together. Like, and I'm not saying any specific film, but like we've had some experiences, and I have always vowed, like I was like, eventually one day I'm going to make a film. I'm going to give it my all. And I need you to be involved with it. And she promised this to me a long time ago. Well, now like Caitlin's career is really taking off. Like she was just in a Jury Number 2 and she had a scene with Toni Collette. I mean, Caitlin is really just impressing the hell out of me, and I'm so proud of her. And so the fact that she still made time to come back and do this amidst having a real career in the industry, I'm blessed to have her. I mean, her performance, I think, and I'm not saying this, I guess it's kind of selfish, but seriously, just as someone watching her do what she does, I think her performance, especially towards some of the climactic scenes, is really breathtaking, and I'm so impressed by her. But making a film is a communal experience. It is a hell of a time. It can be so stressful, but the beautiful moments that you're sharing with these people, the moments where you're really creating your art together, it's something to be savored, and you want to share it with people that you love, like people that you want to have in your circle. So like Rachel Anderson, I mean, I've known Rachel for years. Like I was doing theater with her before we ever did a film together. And I always bring her back whenever I can. And luckily she's always willing to. Gives a hell of a performance for the little bit of time she's on camera here. But I'm trying to think. I think there's like Angelia DeLuca, Angelia Green. She's now married, but I've known her since she was Angelia DeLuca. She was in Chill the Killing Games, which is one of the earliest films I ever did. Back in like, we filmed that in like 2010. And like, she now has a whole career and she's married and everything. And she still came back to do this. And like, she doesn't even really work in film anymore, but I always envisioned her in the role of Coral ever since I started writing this script years ago. And so there's certain people that I wrote parts specifically envisioning them, and I was really lucky that they agreed to do it. So yeah. I'm really lucky to be surrounded by wonderful, talented, amazing people. I do this because I love spending time with them. So it's really kind of a blessing. Jason Eno, that's another one. I went to high school with Jason. We went to a private Catholic school together. Jason then went off New York, amazing performer. I mean, you should hear Jason sing, just so talented. And then happened to come back to Cleveland while I was casting. And I really knew I wanted the character of TJ. I really wanted to have someone of color in that role because I think it was really important. Cleveland is a very diverse melting pot of a city. And I just like, it just has to, I have to have some representation in this role specifically, especially considering one of the bigger scenes that they have towards the climax of the film. I really wanted someone of color in that role, and like timing just aligned. And I was so lucky to have Jason come into that and absolutely just kills it. So yeah, I'm very lucky to have the cast. I'm sorry to like drag on about it, but there's just so many people to celebrate in this film. And I'm just blessed to have that much talent surround me.
I mean, it's a great cast. I mean, you're part of the cast as well. We get to see you.
I give myself a little something. Yeah. Not as big as Rebirth. That was. Yeah. I learned my lesson. I learned my lesson with that.
You just. I forgot the line that killed me when I was watching it. I just couldn't stop laughing because it's like, I know that melting point of stress moment. So, yeah, you're very fun in it. But everyone's just great in the film. Like, it feels like you wrote specific things for specific people because it just works so well. So I think that's just a testament to everything, I guess, and it came together, which is awesome.
Thank you for saying that.
Little tangent there, but...
And also, I love the soundtrack to the film as well. How did putting the soundtrack together to this film come about? Because there's a lot of really awesome club bangers throughout this film.
The soundtrack was extremely evolutionary, but it was really kind of established. Tosca Bear, who is a friend of mine I've known for years, a good friend with one of my exes who I'm still really close with, so we've always just stayed in touch. And he started pursuing his music career a few years ago and just kind of dove all into it. And Prom Queen Days was one of the first songs I ever heard, and I heard it and I was like, I can just see the world. I can envision the gay bar in my mind. And that's the song that opens the film. You've got this big elaborate credit sequence that's really meant to stylistically enter you into the world of the gay bar. And that song was kind of the blueprint, honestly, for the film. I developed so much of the aesthetic and just the overall vibe of the film listening to that song on repeat, along with a couple other tracks. Actual tracks you would know from St. Vincent, Fast Slow Disco. There are just certain songs that I was just really vibing with. Georgia, About Work the Dance Floor is another one, and just helped me kind of create this world. So I kind of knew the vibe I wanted, the sound I wanted. I feel it would have been really easy to just have someone do an EDM beat for all the gay bar scenes and be like, doo, 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 doo. And okay, that's, I guess, a certain gay bar, if you're in a big city, but I grew up in Cleveland and there's different scenes here. There's different crowds. There's different gay bars to go with those crowds. And I really wanted to tap into the sounds of almost yesterday, the sounds you would hear in a grungy Euro leather gay bar in the late 90s, or even back to the late 80s, early 90s, that kind of that dance, that house sound that was developing. Bring that vibe in there. And just it gave me a lot of room to just kind of explore. I connected with a lot of artists. You've got some really respectable artists who have been doing big things lately on the soundtrack, and I'm really humbled that any of these artists would want to work with me at all, considering this overall size of my project. It's a pretty small-scale feature that was majority self-funded. But Bright Light, Bright Light, has performed with Elton John. We've got some wonderful artists, and it was really just a matter of finding tracks that I felt really connected with the piece, with the scene, because I like to edit to the song and really almost a music video. I like to build off of it. And a majority of these people said yes. And so I was very, very lucky. And then of course I have Butterfly Temple Studios, Joshua Love, who composed the soundtrack. And so Joshua really had to immerse themselves in just kind of this sonic world that I was creating, and took the sounds and the samples that were already there and developed a wonderful soundtrack that I think greatly encompasses a lot of different moods and feelings, but still stays rooted often in that kind of gay bar universe. It naturally just kind of builds off the songs and the samplings that you hear throughout the film. So I feel it's really cohesive. I really hope eventually we can release a soundtrack, actually release it, because I've gotten so many compliments on the score and the soundtrack, and I think it is something that deserves to be celebrated.
Yeah, everything really just fits and works. And yeah, I'm glad Bede brought it up, because it's such a great aspect to the film as well. But I feel like we have to ask, I guess, the killer costume, the stud. where did that, I was it an idea to just go let's go full leather and just stud everything? It's so iconic that I love it.
like, true story here. Like, so originally there was a concept for the stud to have multiple costumes, and each one was stylized for the victim. And obviously, like, that's elaborate. Like, that's, I'm not pulling that off. I did costume everyone in this film, I have to say that. So I am really specific about my costuming. But, yeah, like, it was such an evolutionary process. And probably one of the first things that really took form. When it came down to the actual costume, there's only two variations of the stud. I knew I wanted to involve, like, incorporate fetish wear. I knew I wanted it to be sexy. But one film I keep referencing, I don't know if either of you have seen it. Have you ever seen the film Hellbent?
Yes, yes.
I actually know of, have not seen.
I actually have the DVD of it here, because that was the movie I bought at Lee's memorial garage sale.
Oh, that was in his collection.
So, yep, it was. And yeah, that's like, is there. So I definitely know what you mean, but I'll have to lend you the DVD, Marcy, so you can watch it too.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I think Marcy's going to enjoy it quite a lot for an array of reasons. But you know what? That came out, I think it was, I want to say it was 2004. It was relatively early 2000s. And it was like kind of the first of its kind. And it's amazing. Like, I have a blast watching this film, especially considering when it came out. Like, it was very ahead of its time. But there's also certain things about it that feel a bit dated. But, like, that's inevitable. It was 2004. But overall, like, really impressive that they even created a queer piece of horror cinema at that time. And the killer is very sexy. I mean, the killer is, like, shirtless, and he's, like, jacked, and he's, like, so sexy, and that's, like, their shtick. That's their thing, and I knew I didn't want to do the same thing. I wanted something that was scary, but first and foremost, like, was intimidating, and then the sexiness, like, followed. Like, there's an element of it that's kind of sexy. So I played with a lot of fetish wear. My main stud, because there's several actors that played the stud depending on the stunt, but the main stud, Corey Blackledge, is a friend of mine whom I've known for years, and honestly, like, had an array of fetish suits, and I was like, can I, like, just have you, like, model these? I'm trying to build this aesthetic. And he had this one, and I was like, Corey, I was like, this is exactly what I need. Can I kind of, like, just build off this? And he was like, yes, absolutely. So I added fisting gloves. I added a harness. I added a leather, like, scarf, because there's, like, the whole hanky code. So I've incorporated that in there. And the jacket was a jacket of mine that I had originally bought, wanting to incorporate for my own fashion. And I was like, this is, what am I going to do with this? And I enhanced it a bit and threw it on there, and it all just kind of came together. I mean, listen,
it's so good.
When I got the jacket is really when I was like, this is starting to come together. Like, I bought it, but I was like, I know what I want to use this for. And so, like I said, I enhanced it, and I wanted the stud to feel sexy, but also feel like a moving weapon. So he's very lean. He moves very fast, but there's so many aspects to the costume itself that are dangerous. It's not just the weapons the stud's using, like, he is a weapon. And so I think that's why he doesn't feel hokey. People seem to really respond to the stud, really like the aesthetic, the overall look. And, like, that's really flattering. Like, if I'm going to get compliments on my killer, like, that's a big check, like a big green check.
It's
check
very
it off a box.
Iconic looking.
Say it again.
But it's also like, I really want a back scratch, but I feel like that thing might cut up my back rather than scratch it. So I think you nailed it perfectly.
Thank you. They are pointy and they are dangerous, and that mask has no peripheral vision. Just ask Corey, who I made. Corey, who's not an actor. Like, I literally was like, I'm bringing you on as, like, a model, and I'm making you play this very demanding role. And I made him run down a staircase at one point in a mask that has no peripheral vision. You can't see through that mask. He just had to time his steps while holding double samurai swords. So, like, all of that was done on a hope and a prayer, because he could not see anything in front of him.
Yeah, I was going to ask. You can't see through that mask,
no,
right?
You can't.
There's your answer, B.
It was all just about timing things.
Well, that's the thing, though. I think it is a pretty great costume in the film. Now, when you kind of were developing the look of the killer, because developing the look of a killer in a slasher film is always very important, was that exactly what you envisioned when you came up with the look for the killer? Or was it a mixture of, like, you had this initial idea, and then, of course, during the process of making the film, there were changes and all that along the way to create the stud as he is in the film?
When I first, like, designed it and actually did a sketch just of what I wanted, it was like a duster. I wanted him almost like in a Hellraiser kind of vibe. But yeah, one of the things I learned, and also this is like Chill the Killing Games had kind of a similar duster aesthetic. And I was like, this is just for fast sequences, it's kind of restrictive. But when, if it's made out of leather, because I knew I wanted a leather aesthetic, I was like, this is going to be really hard to work in. So we pivoted to what is like that really fitted, which is like a vinyl like bodysuit. Or maybe it's rubber. It's something like that. Well, you oil it up, it looks great on camera. And so that, I was really, really happy with that because I felt like it gave him a very unique silhouette. Like when you think of most killers, for the most part, you think of big, bulky, like hulking, intimidating, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've got Leatherface. You've got Jason is a kind of a similar aesthetic. I wanted something that felt very different from that, so I wanted lean and fast. And so it just kind of lent to it. We did a trial run where it was the costume, but it was missing some of the additional enhancements. Like the initial test run on it didn't have a harness. It didn't have a handkerchief around the neck. And one of the things I wasn't liking is, like, you were seeing areas of the skin. And I wanted it to be, like, this could be anybody.
Yeah.
Like, this could be anyone. You don't know the color of the person. It could be a female or a female-identifying individual binding. Because that's a lean, kind of slinky physique, almost. And so I purposely added more to it to just bulk it up a bit. And I'm happy I did. I'm really, really happy with how it turned out. I think all of the pieces feel very uniform. And, like, really, like, we have been getting so much love for the look of the killer. He's also really fun to light. Like, Marcy, you mentioned the lighting earlier. Well, a lot of the lighting was also really dictated by how the stud looked in the lighting. I mean, you throw a red light on him, and he's just sparkling. Like, it's so fun to play with that. It gave us so many options.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think it just came together really well. Like, it's memorable, it's iconic. I wouldn't personally want to wear the mask and not see anything, but
neither would I. It took a very brave person to do that.
Not to know where the hell I'm going wearing that thing, and I'll poke somebody's something or other, no doubt.
It's definitely happened a couple times.
It's the perfect mask to headbutt someone if they're annoying.
Yeah.
A missed opportunity, to be honest. And if there is a sequel, there will be. There will be a headbutting. I assure you. A shoulder butting.
Well, I mean, you could, if there is a Meat 2.
Oh, there's a script. It's called Meat to the Bone, I'll already tell you. And that's so I can claim the title now. If somebody takes that, you've heard it here, folks. Meat to the Bone, that's the sequel.
It's just got to be one word, like Step Up to the Streets. Like, just one word. No, like, common in between. Just that whole word, because that is a great subtitle for a sequel. But yeah, Roger, if I only had one request for the sequel, definitely do a massive headbutting scene with the killer, but it's over and over again. They just use their head with that mask on to kill someone.
It is literally in the script, and I feel like I now have to adjust it. Like, no, seriously, like, literally, because I've had so many people say, like, oh, that mask, I was waiting for him to headbutt somebody, and I'm like, well, I have to do it, and he's going to have to kill them like that, so, like...
And there's many ways that that could be happening. So there's lots of fun to be had.
But I guess that could be a wrap on our interview.
Well, we can't go without saying, if when people do get a chance to see this movie, if you look at the, was it Wanted or Missing posters, there might be a familiar face on the board.
Yes.
Did you see your beaming face there? I made sure to put it nice and clear.
I mean, I appreciate, well, for a bit of context for our listeners out there, I contributed to Meat's Indiegogo campaign. I do have a special thanks credit in the credits. But also, I think I went for the tiers, like, you could have a missing poster in the film. So I said, Roger and his crew, one of my photos. And if you look very carefully in a scene at the police station, you can see me up on a whiteboard. Like, it's a little blurry, but I know that head anywhere when I see
know
it,
that so. Head anywhere too.
I mean, if you've seen my head in the background of Ricky Stenicki, it's easy to find my head in Roger's film.
I'll never do a perk like that again, only because it is so difficult to find a reason to have that many wanted posters. I was like, shit, like I had more people go for the wanted posters than anything. So we have like a montage of wanted posters. We have them just backdrops of wanted posters. But I made sure to get every damn person on that wall. So hopefully everybody sees their face. It took some creative editing, but we did want to make sure people felt represented and didn't feel cheaped out. So thank you so much to you and anyone else who contributed to the Indiegogo campaign, because it was a 3-tier Indiegogo campaign. We ran it 3 times, and it wasn't until the 3rd time that we finally hit the goal that we had set for ourselves and surpassed it. So it was really nice to see the growing well of support, like going from like nobody knows about this project to now all these people coming out and supporting it. It was heartwarming. It was really, really satisfying as a creative to have that many people come out and want to see your project, your team's project, because it's so many people, come to fruition. That was really, really awesome. So thank you for supporting.
Definitely. And yeah, like I said before, I guess this could be a wrap on our interview with you, Roger. And thank you so much for coming on the Super Podcast to talk about Meet with Marcy and I. We deeply appreciate it. And
absolutely.
Before we wrap up, Roger, where can people find you on the internet this week in terms of your podcast and any other work you have out there? But also, where is Meat currently playing on the festival circuit right now that people can go out and check it out if it's playing near them, or what's coming up for the film in that regard so people can keep a lookout for it in the future?
Yeah, this is exciting because it's like with the film festival journey, like things keep coming up and I've never like had that. Like I have so many like cool screenings and events coming up. So first I'll say like social media, the Scream Queer on Instagram, that's normally where I tend to go. Feel free to add on Facebook. We've got a Meet the Movie page and I have an actress page, Roger Connors as well. So certainly find me there. I loved it. Chat about the genre with anybody I can chat with. My podcast is now back in full swing now that I'm recovered from a little surgery I had recently. I did take some time off, but we're now back at Dark Knight of the Podcast, releasing regular episodes. And I've been just popping on a lot of different pods recently as this is starting to build up to a really exciting next phase for me. So I'm so happy that you're one of the early podcasts I got to go on to talk about this. Because again, yeah, not many people have seen it, but it did just recently play in Perth. So I definitely want to appreciate the Perth Queer Film Festival that chose to include us as part of their lineup. Really wonderful lineup that they had to offer. And there was a film that we were paired with. I just want to note it because it's an Australian short called Eat the Meat that is... like, it was meant to be lined up with Meat. Like, how could you not? But it was really great, and it was just so unique and unlike anything I'd seen. So I wanted to give them a little hat tip because I really enjoyed that short. But yeah, we're going to be playing next in Manchester, England. We'll be playing at the Gasp Horror Film Festival, Queer Horror Film Festival. That's in June. We are playing at Fairy Tales in Alberta, Canada. That is coming up, I believe it's in May. And then in a couple of weeks, I'll be in Toronto at the Toronto Indie Horror Film Festival. Actually be there representing me. And another film I did, Hollow Lake, that I act in, actually somehow got selected to the same festival. We don't know these people. It was just a weird coincidence. But I'll be there with my podcast co-host, Troy Escamilla, representing that film as well. So if you're Canadian and you happen to be in Toronto, look us up.
Awesome.
Very exciting.
Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week, but also where can people find all things the Super Podcast?
Well, as we said as we introduced the show, supermarcy.com, basically. Or just look up Super Marcy and you'll find the podcast or something.
Yes.
But you can show your support on patreon.com/thesupernetwork. We are the Super Network on the various social media. You can look up the Super Podcast or the Super Network on your podcast streaming platforms. And me, I'm Super Marcy on the socials. Not terribly active on a lot of them these days because of terrible algorithmic crap. But I'm still there. Yes. I'll answer messages and whatnot. And if you so dare, you can add me on Letterboxd at super_Marcy and see what movies you will question why I rated 5 stars on.
definitely. And if people would find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can find all my work and as well as all the other awesome podcasts that you and I do together, Marcy, on the Super Network. And also, you can follow my solo podcast, Bede vs. the Living Dead, on all podcast streamers everywhere. And kind of slightly plug that episode, which Roger has been on twice for. One, as part of an episode where we talked about Rebirth, but also Roger, when you joined Marcy and I as a guest on the Dawn of the Dead remake episode. So definitely check those episodes out. They were a lot of fun.
Very good one. It was a good time. And I was supposed to be on one. My back screwed that up, but check me off for another because I want to come back and talk about something zombie related because I haven't talked zombies in a hot minute. All it's been is slashers, and I got to talk about some zombies. So get me on the list.
Don't worry. I think we could arrange that for sure, Roger. But
thank you.
We'll definitely get you back on, I guess, both Bede's solo show, but also anything on the Super Network as well.
Yes, please. Now, I'm now like ready and raring to go. I'm able to jump back in the pool with y'all. And as always, I really love sitting down. It's just a fun time talking with you two. Sometimes I like go into a podcast. I'm like, oh, I feel like awkward. And like, I know with you two, I'm going to be like, oh, I'm going to let my hair down a little bit.
Yeah.
Have a good time. So, and that makes for the best content.
Although, not in my case, no hair at all. But
no, you know, hair at all.
But that's fair, beside the point.
Your figurative hair is down.
Exactly. But thank you to everyone who listened to this special interview episode of the Super Podcast. And we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye.
And don't forget to beat your meat. No, that was wrong.
You don't get it, do you? It doesn't look good, us being together with you. But we're here because we care. I'm here because I care.
You know what's not tasting right? The fact that out of everyone, I'm the one that's in this position.
All that chit chat, ain't it a man to get his name? No wonder we're so single, Noah. Well,
four years later, how do you respond to his upcoming release?
What was it like? Like, for real?
Prison?
It's just Noah.
It's Noah after 4 fucking years because of that asshole. Places like that changes people. My dad told stories about people who get locked up.
Time to go sleep off whatever all this is.
I show up and people start dying.